Hi, Todd Feinberg here. After six, this one's a little unusual. We had a new regular guest, Richard Grossman. He's an economist, a researcher in economics from Wesleyan University. And he's been on a couple times with us before. But in this one, we got a little political and it got a little heated, and which I think is great. You know, I don't take it personally if we disagree. I love it when we disagree on the air, when there is disagreement, especially when that disagreement provides some clarity between people of different positions. So we were talking about the well, I don't exactly know how we got where we got, but our conversation ended up in a dispute over the nature of the Trump administration and what underpins it, because I have this theory that it's underpinned by a sense of the government no longer being a functioning entity. And that's not unique to me. That was a big theory about the 2016 election cycle, not just why Donald Trump did so well, but also why Bernie Sanders did so well. There was a rebellion in the air. Hillary Clinton represented the worst of entrenched government, undemocratic government, and therefore there was a sense that voting for her would be voting for a continuation or a vote of support for the institutional malaise that people feel, that there's this sense out there that your vote doesn't work. Why doesn't your vote work? Why does it feel that we don't have democracy in action in America anymore? And that's what I intended to talk about. And the discussion with the discussion with Dr. Grossman, it was fascinating, but unfortunately he got a little more emotional than I would have liked, maybe, because I think if we have it to do again, if we could spend a little more time on it and maybe stay a little calmer, that he'd be able to get deeper into the conversation with me. But it was illuminating in this way, and that is that I think there is a split in the country around the idea of whether you are comfortable with how the insiderism of the country works. That is, if it is a rigged system, that resonant language still hanging around from Bernie Sanders. He was talking about Wall Street. But I think the reason that language became the defining language of the 2016 election was because people have a sense that everything is rigged, that insiders control America. And there's not much room for little people exercising their vote to have influence anymore. And this isn't an accusation against Professor Grossman at all. I think he's just a guy who's worked within the system. He said one of his early jobs was working in the State Department, and he works at Wesleyan University. He's inside institutions, and he's been very successful being there. And it's natural for people with that kind of resume to feel good about the continual commitment that we have to what the Democrats call democratic norms. That is, they've been arguing that the great horror of Donald Trump is that we're failing to do things the way we've always done things. We're breaking patterns. And that's a legitimate concern, because that's what Trump does do. He disrupts everything. However, the flip side of that same coin, and this is the point I was trying to make to Richard Grossman, but I felt like I wasn't successful making, because he got mad at me. And that is that definitionally, if you are going to succeed by a commitment to always following standards, then eventually power will form around those standards in ways that become undemocratic, because the natural instinct of those who have power to want to control everything finds the nooks and crannies that it can use to insinuate itself into power and gain more control than it's supposed to have in a one-man, one-vote kind of system. Anyway, that was the framework of the conversation. I think it's a fascinating, constructive conversation. So here it is to listen to. And since it was so riveting, we kept going. And this will be the longest After Six segment, I think, that we've done that was recorded originally specifically for After Six. So we will run through the we'll stop for our bottom of the hour news, but then we'll keep going with the conversation with Dr. Grossman. So enjoy. It's a great conversation. We'll do it right now on WTIC News Talk 1080. Welcome to After Six. Todd Feinberg with you. Richard Grossman is back. He's an economist, and therefore he understands things that we don't, normal people don't, and brings us a different perspective on what's going on in the world. Professor, let's talk a little Brexit. Tell us where we're at right now with Brexit. Is it going to happen? Is it dead? What's going on?
Heaven knows. Brexit's been going on for a while. Just sort of for a quick refresher, back in 2016, the British had a vote as to whether or not they should leave the European Union. The European Union is a customs union and a free trade union amongst 28 European countries. And at the time, the British Prime Minister, David Cameron, was having a little trouble with the right wing of his Conservative Party. They kept giving him grief about still being in the European Union, and they were very unhappy. So he figured, well, I'll shut them up. We'll have a vote. We'll have a referendum. And so he promised to have a referendum, which no one thought was going to pass. And the referendum was one sentence that says the British should get out of the EU, which, you know, didn't say what percentage had a vote for it or what was going to happen, just that was the referendum. So
and the purpose of doing it politically was to do away with this movement, to somehow nullify it, right, so they could move on politically?
Right. He was basically trying to slap down the people in his party who were very much anti-EU. He himself was pro-EU, and he kept trying to get a slightly better deal because the British have a very big financial services sector, and he was trying to get a better deal for the City of London's financial services. And he kept coming back with something less than what the party wanted. And finally, he said, look, I'll shut them up. I'll promise a referendum. And he promised the referendum, and he campaigned vigorously for Britain to stay in the EU. And then they voted about 52-48 to leave. But the problem with that is they didn't really have a plan. I mean, we're talking a one sentence. Think about it as a constitutional amendment in the United States. For us to have a constitutional change, you got to go through 3/4 of the states have to approve it after Congress votes for it for 2/3 in each house.
The hoops you have to jump through are clearly laid out. This was its own hoop, but had none of the solutions built into it. So it was essentially commanding the government to undo something that was a tall order to execute.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so there was no roadmap and no idea of exactly how they're going to do it. And the Brits have been in since the 70s, so a large chunk of their law has been written into EU law, or vice versa. That is, a lot of EU law is written into British law. So if they want to separate from the EU, they've got to write their own laws that basically replicate everything that was there before. So they had been basically going with European law on a lot of things. So Cameron resigns. He's replaced by Theresa May. She goes. She does a deal with the folks in Brussels, with the EU, to make a withdrawal agreement. She brings it back to Parliament. She's shut down cold. She loses on all accounts. So let me just say, the economic view of Brexit is that economically it's a losing proposition for the British. This is going to make them poor. It's not going to bankrupt them. It's not going to make them turn them into a less developed country, but it's going to make them poor. It's going to make the country as a whole poor.
And poorer by, so you said not to a monumental degree, but to what degree would you guess, Professor Grossman, does leaving the EU damage the gross domestic product of England?
I think the estimates that I've seen say anywhere from like 3-10% over the next few years. So it's not tiny. It's not trivial.
It's noticeable, but life goes on.
Yeah, I mean, in the United States, let's say 3% of GDP would be about the size of our transportation sector. So if you can imagine all our transportation sector going bust and think about the effect of that just as size of GDP. I mean, we're talking something large. So that's, you know, a major problem. But so Theresa May brings a deal. She can't get the deal passed. She resigns, and Boris Johnson goes to Brussels with a worse deal. And now Parliament is saying, well, yes, but we want to take a closer look at it. So that's where we're at the moment. It's interesting to watch. It's a train wreck. We're sort of watching a train wreck in slow motion.
And what's wrong with that, given that this is government and that, you know, let's sort out our philosophical differences here. This has always excited me. The whole story you just told, I find exciting. Not just the vote for England to leave the undemocratic structure of the EU and put power back in the hands of the people, but also just to disrupt that which is. And that's what the Trump election is about. And if you are somebody who operates on the inside of the power structure, I would guess as an economic researcher, as you are, Wesleyan, that you're firmly steeped in the power structure, and therefore you want predictability, you want norms to be followed, you want things preserved. And you want that without regard necessarily for noticing or feeling the degree to which that might be no longer democratic, it might be a rigged system, because it seems to me is inevitable. I would assume that part of studying economics is to look at the natural arcs of things, and I have this sense of the politics of our nation that after 250 years or whatever it is, that a liberty-based society has naturally structured itself around whatever the limitations on rigging power are. As hard as our founders worked to make sure that you couldn't make our democratic system undemocratic, that everybody who's in the power structure, who's got wealth, who's got land, who's got a business going, is looking to preserve what is. That's nature. And after 250 years of that, it seems like all the power's divvied up and it's become a country in which on the surface we have democracy going on, but democracy is not affecting the course of our country. That is done by insiders who control everything. That's my sense of America. I assume that's what's going on in Europe. And even though this rigged system brings them 3 to 10% more affluence on paper each year, they want to have a chance to exercise some liberty. Give us your response to that.
I guess I would say that, you know, in terms of, I don't think we want to burn the house down. I think there are ways to make the world a better place. There's certainly a lot of ways for the British to have made a better deal with the European Union. I don't view the European Union as being terribly undemocratic. I think that all the institutional structures are there. If you want to tear down some of the institutional structures and make it better, hey, I think that's great. But I think what the British did, and I think what some of your friends in the United States are doing, they just want to tear things down for the sake of tearing them down. I think you have to have some idea of what's going to remain after you burn your bridges and after you burn the town down. You have to figure out what the town's going to look like after.
But that's a contradiction in terms. This is a modern form of rebellion, a nonviolent, democratic, somewhat form of rebellion. And what happened was they wrote that one sentence down and let the people vote on it. And that became a crack in the wall. And the people who put it there cynically, thinking they could manipulate the people with this little crack they designed, instead it got weaponized because there was demand in the marketplace for change, that the demand had no path through which to flow. So it found this little crack and it rushed through.
Well, again, I it's not clear to me that this is a giant step towards liberty. I think this is a giant step towards making Britain a lot poorer than it used to be.
Yes, but you would have said the same thing perhaps as the American Revolution got started, as many people did, as most people did.
Well, I wasn't there, so I couldn't tell you what I'd say. But I think, but it's reasonable to say that there were a lot of people at the time that thought that America was soon, if not at that moment, then would very soon be too big to be ruled by Britain. The French foreign minister said as much. He said, these people, this is too big an enterprise. This is too much for the British. So I don't think
historians tell us that the majority of the ruling class was on the side of the Brits. And that makes sense because that's where the power came from and the ruling class has the power.
But the realists knew that this was not a sustainable situation, that they were not going to stay under the rule of the British forever, and that this country was getting to be too big and too powerful to be ruled by the British. So again, I think this notion of we want a revolution. I don't think we need a revolution in the United States at the moment. I don't think the British need a revolution.
I don't think anyone thinks they do, but still there needs to be a refreshing of the system because the natural order of things is for calcification to take place and things to become less democratic.
Well, you know, vote the bums out. I always think that's a reasonable approach. I think that's a reasonable approach to political issues, and you can certainly vote in new people. But I'm not sure we need something quite as revolutionary. I don't think the British need something quite as revolutionary as the withdrawal from the
EU. Yeah, well, that's what the tension is over, and I think it's a beautiful thing to have played out and shouldn't be viewed. We're talking with Richard Grossman, by the way, professor from Wesleyan in economics. These kinds of things are messy by definition. The expression of power from the people is a messy concept. And yes, throw the bums out, but what if the bums are all working together and the illusions of difference between them are not legitimate? They're just illusions. The impression that we get that there is a left and a right that you can express through the Democrats and Republicans may not be that different because they're all ruling class people who are more committed to norms. So I don't mean to keep hitting the same note because you've said what your answer is, but I do think it's important that everybody understand that we are getting more steeped in the way things are because power has so much power. And so we hear these arguments in the political marketplace about these little signals that people measure, which I don't think necessarily speak to a huge problem all by themselves, but they're hooks that get used, like income inequality. That's a statement that says the power has too much power and the weak has too much weakness. And how do you propose that those things get reconciled, given that we've been having elections for 250 years, and so we have been throwing the bums out on occasion, we still get the same result, which is a steady movement towards a feeling that things are rigged on behalf of the havers, not on the wanters?
Well, that changes over time. I mean, again, this is a country that had slavery for quite a long time, and we managed to get rid of that, and that was a relatively bloody process. We've had in this country times when income inequality has risen and times when income inequality has declined. Some of the greatest increases in income inequality happened during the biggest financial expansions. So we've had, for the last 30 or so years, we've had income inequality increase, and that's clearly something that people are concerned about, and that does affect the way people vote, and it affects their interests. And so the question is, if we care about this, then we have to think of how to change the system and how to improve the lot of people whose is not as great as it could be. Again, a lot of people voted for Donald Trump. I'm not sure that there's anything in anything that Donald Trump has done or proposed that lowers the income gap, the inequality.
Well, I'm not proposing the income gap as a problem. I think it's a phony talking point that some clever person designed because they realized there was this tension, this nervousness in the marketplace of ideas. And they wanted to politicize that. They wanted to convert that sense of the voter into power. And they used it with this talking point that brought people who had that sensation over into that argument and to push for that thing. But I only bring it up because I think it's a signal that these kinds of sensations are alive in this country, and that if the power structure, if the democratic processes, which are supposed to provide cause and effect, if there is a need in the marketplace, if a market's working, it generates automatically the fulfillment of that need. But in politics, the tendency is to rig those systems so that they can't respond democratically. That is, we don't get one man, one vote. We get certain people who have way disproportionate ability to affect the way power moves. And the little people who are supposed to have one vote instead have 1/1000th of a vote or something like that. And people feel that, and they know something's wrong. So when a chance comes along to hit the power structure upside the head, it's not rational necessarily, but it's for lack of other way to voice their opinions. They vote for Brexit or they vote for Trump.
Well, they've certainly done both.
Yeah, so you regret
even
that.
Though
but,
this, even though this is likely to make both constituencies worse off.
But, you know, Jefferson said there's got to be bloodshed every 20 years or so if you want to maintain democracy. And I think he was, while his timing maybe was a little aggressive, I think what he was understanding was that this kind of dynamic was an unavoidable arc of power. That it doesn't matter what kind of security you build into a system to make sure that the powerful don't take too much control, that they're eventually going to do it. And that's what I feel like we're doing. So I don't even know what the point of the conversation is.
How have we ejected the powerful? Who?
What's that?
What powerful interest group have we gotten rid of? Have we gotten rid of the oil and coal industries that are now holding cabinet positions? Who have we gotten rid of?
Well, I think this war, the reveal that's taken place, you don't always know where these things are going. But I think that we now understand that we have built a government class that is so powerful and is now in control of the government, not our elected officials. They're just along for the ride. As long as they get the perks of being in power, they run for re-election. That's what our elected officials spend most of their time doing.
Well, aside from all the guys who are dropping out because they can't stand to be there.
Yes, because they're no longer meaningful people and they don't want to be part of the charade anymore.
But isn't this part of the renewal of democracy? We throw out some people quit because they see they have no future and we move on.
No, I don't think the elected officials are part of running the country anymore, and that's why they're leaving.
So who are the problem? You're speaking like a conspiracy theorist, and that's making me a little bit nervous.
Oh, good. I love that. But I'm not. I don't go for conspiracy theories. I'm just looking at the evidence. I've watched Trump, who is, I'll grant that he's outrageous in the way he conducts himself, but I've seen the resistance to Trump launch on the day of his election, if not before, and start talking about impeachment on the day of his election, if not before. And
tell me that if Hillary Clinton hadn't been elected, the Republicans wouldn't be halfway through an impeachment inquiry by now as well.
Well, that may be true.
Of course it's true.
Well, I don't know.
Are you kidding me? Trey Gowdy, all these guys, they were totally on board with impeaching Clinton. I think that you've got sort of a one-sided view here, Todd.
Well, thank you. Expand on that. Go ahead.
Well, because, you know, first of all, you say there's this elite, and then you say, but it's not the people who run the government, it's the someone else. You know, most of the civil servants, many years ago, I worked for the State Department, and I think you can see it in some of the guys who show up to testify in the impeachment inquiry. These are the vast majority of people I met in public service. And again, I was a young man just out of graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
The vast majority of these people, they thought they could do some good in the world. They were patriots. They're like people who serve in the military. It's a different type of service, but it is nonetheless service of their country. And these people felt like they could do some good in the world. And I think that when people like you or others say that there's an entrenched elite and the foreign service offices are all awful, or the people in our security services, or the people in the intelligence services are somehow not reliable, I think that does far more damage to democracy than many of the other things you seem to be concerned about.
But there's clear evidence that that there are people inside the government, including James Comey, who confessed it, that he released documents in order to get a special counsel appointed in order to try to get Trump out of office. I mean, and in the early days of the Trump administration, there were leaks that would happen before he had a chance to walk back to his desk. The discussion he just had in another room in the White House would be out in the news media.
As the president isn't alone in a room with some Russians so that he can pass along the secret intelligence of our country and other countries, then I think that, you know, I don't think anyone should be leaking. I agree with that. But as a matter of fact, it happens in Washington all the time. It's bad. It should be found out. People who leak should be fired or arrested or whatever happens to have. But frankly, if you're going to talk about people leaking government secrets, I think you have to start with the president. This is a guy who let into the Oval Office Russian official state photographers. This is, when I worked for the government, you didn't get to go over there unless you were very, very serious. The screenings were going on. This guy seems to have no concern about the security of this country. 11,000 Kurds have died. We seem to have abandoned them. Now, again, you might say, well, the old system would be you just hang on to an alliance because they're old elites. So I don't think of the Kurds as elites. I think of the Kurds as people who've been friendly to us and who've been an efficient fighting force, have done a lot of our dirty work. And we managed to leverage the work of a couple thousand American servicemen with tens of thousands of Kurdish soldiers, and they seem to have accomplished a lot. But this president, in the argument of, you know, as you would say, of bringing fresh air or breaking the mold, we've broken not only our alliance with the Kurds. Everyone in the Middle East who used to believe that the United States would do what it said it was going to do no longer believes that. And those include our very good friends and some people who are moderate friends. But they don't believe that the person who's running this country is going to do what the United States has committed to doing.
Stop right there, because what you're arguing is that I'm arguing everything Trump is doing is good, and I'm not.
You're saying that all we need to do is we need to bust the system now and then. And you're pointing out Trump as an example of us busting up the system. And I'm saying this is a busting up of the system that's also burning down the house.
Well, in that particular case, you may be right with regard to the Kurds. But the finer point I wanted to make is that there is a fine line, I think, between the noble actors inside the government who have absorbed this way of doing things and them stepping up and saying, we don't like this president because he's breaking norms. Therefore, we will work and use our power out of the nobility of our sense of purpose to the norms that have always been to destroy him. And I think that has been going on. Do you see no evidence of that?
I just think you're mischaracterizing it. I think the fact that I don't think it's the breaking of the norms per se that's getting this guy into trouble. What's getting him into trouble is breaking norms in such a horrible way. First, we're going to bomb the Iranians. Then we're not going to bomb the Iranians. First, we're going to help the Kurds. Then we're not allies with the Kurds. You know, maybe next week we'll decide not to be allies with the
no,
French.
But please,
British.
Professor, don't go there again, because I'm not. We're confusing two different arguments. Is he creating a disaster? Let's stipulate that Trump's presidency is disastrous.
Okay.
What is the proper way for that disaster to unfold? Is it for the insiders to use their proximity to what's going on and their insider status to destroy him without us necessarily even seeing how they're doing it? Or is it better for it to make its way back to the next election and for us to remove him from office?
Well, you know, the Founding Fathers put impeachment in the Constitution for a reason. So, I mean, if the Congress finds that they want to impeach him and the Senate finds that they want to convict him, I don't really think of that as being in secret. They're releasing, I don't know what percentage of the transcripts are out there, but I saw Taylor's thing. I think, you know, to say there's some shady conspiracy that's keeping us from getting at the truth. We have elected representatives in this country. Some are Republican, some are Democrat. They will presumably vote on impeachment. And that's a very public thing. I think, you know, if you say we can only wait for an election, then why do the founders put impeachment in the Constitution?
Well, I don't happen to think impeachment is being used with any of the nobility that you ascribe to the State Department insiders and others who you experience. I think it's being done as part of this movement that started before Trump took office. But I'm fine with whatever happens, because I think ultimately Democrats are going to hurt themselves with miscalculating the way they go about this. What bothers me is the idea that we have such a deep, powerful bureaucratic state in Washington, in a federal government that was never designed to be a morbidly obese federal government, and yet that's what we have, where our elected officials go down there, spend half their days off campus raising money, and are in Washington 3 days a week or 4 days a week. Those guys aren't running the government. They don't even know how the government works in many cases. It's hard when there's 18 spy agencies or whatever we have for anybody who's elected to go down to Washington, who even goes there with the purpose of becoming an expert on the U.S. espionage system, to even grab a hold of that much understanding and power over what it does. It's become something other than what it was meant to be in a deliberate attempt to subvert the idea of having an American style of government.
But
and
so
I want to see that thing broken up.
Are you talking about the guys who work for the CIA? Are you saying that they're somehow selling the country out? I don't understand. You can't run a country without some bureaucracy. Now, as it turns out, when administrations turn over, they bring in a lot of new bureaucracy. They don't replace everyone. And again, in the State Department, they don't replace all the Foreign Service officers, but they do replace all the assistant secretaries and the undersecretaries and the secretary and deputy secretary. And they've done that, actually. They've done that several times because they can't seem to find either people who will last or people who don't get fed up. But I think to say, well, we have to get rid of the bureaucracy, you're looking for an enemy. Right?
No,
enemy,
I think we've got an enemy.
We need to. We've got this. There's this elite. There's this secret cabal that's taking care of things. You know, this is something that the United States has had of a long time. People would blame the Queen of England. They would blame the Rothschilds. I think, you know, you're blaming the entrenched superpower of the embedded government in Washington, and I just don't see it.
You don't see any problems with our federal government having become something that is not, as is specifically described for it, not to be in the Constitution?
I think the extent to which the federal government is doing something that's not in accordance with the Constitution, there'll be a boatload of lawyers lining up to sue the federal government to get it changed. And in fact, we have courts that will stand up to the federal government. So again, yes, it's true. Back at the time of the Constitution was adopted, people didn't envision the federal government doing a great deal or doing as much as the state governments. Absolutely true. And in fact, the federal government was relatively small. It got bigger during the Civil War, and it got really big during World War I and World War II. But it also turned out that the world has changed. There are very few countries in the world, in fact, none I can think of, where the state or provincial governments are as powerful as the national government. And that's just the way things are. The problems we have are national. We can't deal with pollution by having Florida do one thing and South Carolina do something else and California do something else. A lot of these problems require nationwide rules. Who makes nationwide rules? The federal government. So I agree there are a lot of problems and there's a lot of overregulation. That's a lot of things you and I could probably agree on. But to blame the federal government for all our ills, or to say that there's an elite or there's a cabal or there's someone that's, you know, manipulating us, I just don't see that.
Well, I wouldn't blame it all on the federal government. I think the state government is a bigger disaster. And
you just don't like government at all, do you, Todd?
What's that?
You just don't like government at all.
Well, I like it to be small and democratic, and I feel that we've wandered away from that. So I feel badly that I'm signaling to you that I'm inclined towards conspiracy theories, because I am absolutely not. To me, that what the founders knew about power is that power is dangerous, and so they designed a system that they thought would be a really tough lock to pick. And I think we've reached a point where the lock has been picked by the plunderers, and the plunderers are busy plundering. They've taken control of these entities.
Well, you know, that's why they put in things like impeachment, and that's why they put in the federal courts. And, you know, impeachment seems to be working its way through. You may or may not like what they find or what they come up with. But, you know, if you want to talk about checks and balances, I mean, impeachment is the ultimate check on the executive, right? If you feel like the executive has engaged in behavior that's inappropriate. I mean, again, the words are high crimes and misdemeanors. That's pretty loose, right? It is what the government, it is what Congress and the House and Senate say it is. And if they feel like abandoning an ally, for example, was a reason to remove a president, then all these guys would be on the bandwagon. So I think that, yes, the founders did. They built in checks and balances. They built in a House and a Senate and an executive and a judiciary, a judicial branch. And the point of it was to make sure that no one side got too much power. They also built in impeachment, which is the ultimate legislative check on the executive. You know, in a parliamentary system, the members of parliament, or the executive is the prime minister. The members of parliament can vote the prime minister out.
Well, he's part of the parliament, so yeah. Yeah, it's we've got to wrap up, but it's a fascinating conversation. I appreciate you taking this journey with me. Because,
always happy to chat, Todd. My pleasure.
Because we have such different ideas. Professor Richard Grossman from Wesleyan, thank you, sir. It's been great.
Nice chatting with you, Todd. Take care.
Bye-bye. So that's the end of the recorded interview that I did this week with Professor Grossman, which I find, as I said before, I think that was really valuable. That's what it feels like. I think you can hear what it feels like for somebody who is part of the I'm trying to figure out how to describe it without it sounding like it's judgmental. I'm not. He's an insider. In a good way. He's worked inside of our systems. People have to do that, and we need our systems. The question is, what do you do when the systems are no longer functioning properly, which is how they're perceived as evidenced by the 2016 election, the popularity of Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, the fact that, by the way, all of the Democrats virtually who are running for president, I don't know, can I just say all of them? They're all advocating for a government that does not in any way reflect the founding principles of our society. And one of my concerns about this sort of reaction that Professor Grossman had is that I don't hear people who understand, educated people like him, objecting to the idea that there is a party in this country firmly committed to the principles of Marxism as espoused by Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and others. And it's bizarre to me that that doesn't create some kind of emotional reaction, because Marxism is contrary to the notion of liberty. And I guess the other thing I want to say is it's important to, when you're hearing what I say, my beliefs, and maybe trying to compare them to your own, I don't really view myself as a political conservative, because political conservatives, that, you know, that comes along with a lot of stuff that I have nothing to do with, like social conservatism coming out of evangelical philosophy or what have you. I have nothing to do with that. I'm about that when you look at power, what you see is that power wants more power. And that's what it does with the power it has. It figures out how to take that power and parlay it into more. That's what the founders believed. And the founders bent over backwards and worked their butts off to make sure that we wouldn't have big centralized government that squandered huge amounts of money and did whatever it felt like without regard for the will of the people, even though they were creating a democratic society, that is, one controlled through the through a Republican form of government by the people. They also were concerned that the people not have too much power, and that the power of the people not become tyrannical. Okay, so they created this system that was going to be very balanced, and that balance and all those different pieces that they created, those were going to diffuse the poignancy of power, the sharp point of it, so that it couldn't be so damaging to us, largely because it would be spread out among so many different people in so many different departments, but also because no one person could easily gain control of the whole shebang. So that's where it feels like this notion of a deep state is something we should take seriously. That is, insiders who stay for long periods of time working in a government have huge control now because we have such such gigantic systems of government in Washington and the same thing in Hartford that squander huge amounts of assets and take away our ability to have democratic, meaningful democratic control over what goes on. So that's the point of the conversation from my point of view. Hope you enjoyed it. I thought it was great. I'm really thankful that Richard Grossman was willing to do it with me, and we look forward to talking with him again next week. That's it for today's After Six. Stay tuned. Coming up after news, it'll be Clark Howard on WTIC News Talk 1080.